men and women radicalized differently through social media, because we cannot lump them together in the same box. It's a different social group. Teenagers also radicalized differently through social media, the same also with adults. So we need to come up with a nuanced understanding.
Everybody, and welcome to Pretty Good Podcast, Digital Rights in the Asia Pacific with Engage Media. I am Red.
And I am Maria.
Social media is a double-edged sword. This is something that we will hear from our guest. Social media, of course, can bring people together, bring families and friends that would otherwise find it difficult. But on the other hand, it can also divide communities. And in worst cases, it can radicalize.
This is the issues that our expert will discuss with us today. He has been working on de-radicalization effort in Indonesia and other places in the region. Joining us today is Nur Huda Ismail, an author, a filmmaker, activist, repentant journalist. One of his most notable works is a film titled Jihad Selfie, about a young Indonesian man recruitment to ISIS, violent jihadist group via social media. Welcome to Pretty Good Podcast, Mas Huda.
Thank you very much for having me, Red and Maria. It is my honor to be part of this cool project.
Thank you. So I want to ask first, you have written several articles about radicalizations and de-radicalizations of members of violent jihadist group, especially those who are recruited via social media. And for the benefit of the audience, perhaps we need a little bit of clarity in the terms that we are going to use at this session. So based on your experience working with these groups, how do we best address them? And, you know, what do we first need to understand in addressing them? And yeah, what are the distinctions?
First of all, there are three things that we need to remember. Very basic concept. What I call it, number one will be BE, banality of evils. These people are banal. It is completely wrong to portray them as a monster, only as a monster. They are banal as individuals. And then number two will be process and relations. No one born as a terrorist. It is a process. And radicalization itself is a super complicated. It's not straightforward. And even radicalization scholar, no, there is no agreement among radicalization scholars in terms of a process itself. But what I can tell based on my own experience and my unique connection to this very issue, because my dad sent me to an Islamic boarding school when I was 12, and the boarding school, the founder of the boarding school is also the founder of JI. Number of individual who involved in terrorism in the region are linked back to my school. So I know them personally. So based on my personal interaction with them, they are ordinary individuals. But there are processes that turn them into terrorists. But in 2014, there was a turning point of my life to look at this issue differently. But because before 2014, because before the declaration of ISIS, people joining violent group, first by joining a collective action first, collective a group first, let's say join in JI, join in MILF, join in Al-Qaeda, then the group mold this individual to be a terrorist, to become a terrorist. So, but 2014, you see massive shift from collective actions into connective actions. You don't need to know physically, you don't need to get involved physically into a specific group, simply because you are connect to the very idea that has been spread widely through social media, internet, and so many different platforms, you can actually get involved. And this is really disturbing phenomena. And then it won't go away anytime soon. So in 2014, since then, my work has been looking at the convergence between online and offline radicalization process. You know, so then recently, to spark the conversation about this very issue, I use a popular culture, which is a documentary film, story about the processes. I hope that having this film, people can have the conversation and start to have ownership of the issue. Because in the past, when people talk about radicalization, terrorism, it always looking at as a state problems, so state security. But in reality, it's not beyond. It's a human security, especially now with the technology. You know, there are Jihad Selfie. Yes, it's my first film to describe, to capture the link between online and offline radicalizations. But the other one, another film called The Bride or Pengantin, a story about three women looking for love in social media. Two of them were recruited to join ISIS. You know, for those hopelessly romantic woman as a migrant worker far away, you are what you call it, you are lonely, and then you can find kind of a connection through social media, and then that's a fascinating phenomenon. At least I'm looking at how the Indonesian migrant worker in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and also here in Singapore, some of them were recruited and even donated money for the cause. And then a film that I'm making at the moment, I call it Radically Romantic, because it's a story about a woman who married woman also because cannot involved in LGBT movement in Hong Kong, then come into one of our publications or posting in social media saying that that kind of activity is not in line with your religions. So she's anxious and worried, and then decided to leave the LGBT community and recruited to the network and readied herself to be a suicide bomber for the third Bali bombing, which is scary. You see, started as a quest for identity, simply want to be part of a redemption. And then because of the social media, lack of digital literacy, people might go down into rabbit hole of radicalization. And this is something that now kind of preoccupied my work at the moment.
All right. And you mentioned several films now, Jihad Selfie, Radically Romantic. In the creation of these films, like, what are your common goals or themes in making them, other than, of course, looking at the different complications and nuances that you just mentioned? Can you talk about your overarching goals?
Yeah, I think the basic goal here is that, yes, technology is important in our life, but we need to understand that it's kind of a double-sword thing. So if you do not understand well how to use it, it might jeopardize not only you as a person but humanity as a whole, you know. So because now with the explosion of social media, it's oftentimes weaponized. The social media has been weaponized by a specific group or individual who has a toxic intention, you know. So that is the reason why, as again, and then especially because I'm looking at the impact of social media for teenagers, the impact of social media for women and adult. So looking at it's a different impact in it's a different social group, because we cannot lump them together in the same box. You know, men and women radicalized differently through social media, and teenagers also radicalized differently through social media. The same also with adult. So we need to come up with a nuanced understanding. It has to do with their digital right to access digital domain, yet they have to make sure that they will be safe, you know, when by accessing this. Something that has been missing in the region, at least in Indonesia now, this kind of campaign.
Yes, and this is really the focus of this conversation that we are having now, that safety and accessing digital technology. Yes, and you mentioned something about impact. So can you talk about the overall impact of your films, what you have observed in the audiences of these? What kinds of outcomes have you seen? And we'd like to hear about these kinds of stories.
Okay, when I produced and directed my first film called Jihad Selfie, I did a massive roadshow in Indonesia, first in Indonesia, you know, in Indonesia, we discussed the impact of quest for a specific type of toxic masculinity, because as a young man, Akbar, back then in the formative years, when I met him first time, he was only 15. And then two of his friends already traveled to Syria, started to post, you know, like kind of masculine figure. So he was driven by such notion. But the way back then, the way authorities or Indonesian public framed this issue always through the lens of religions, ignoring other social factors, such as individual quest for machoism or sense of being a cool man, you know. So when I did that film, and then people start to rethink and revisit the way they interpret this phenomenon and the role of social media, especially the role of social media. And then to my surprise, when I did that film, Rosso, I was approached by a mother, and then who cried later on, saying, told me, oh, Huda, can you help to, you know, to help me? What can I do? I said, 26 of my family left to Syria, and then one of them is because of social media. And then, so you see, the film screening have a direct impact, our approach. And then I start to build communication with these 26 families. And I told the mother, said, look, I'm just a filmmaker, I cannot do much, but see what I can do. So I have a unique connection with my foreign government, with my Minister of Foreign Affairs. We start to talk about this very issue. Then I was deeply involved in the evacuation process, and I turned that process, the rescue call, the repatriation process, into film called Seeking the Imam, story about Dania, 17 years old girl who was radicalized. She was radicalized through social media too. And then she decided to travel along with the 26 of her family. And then now the film has been used here in Singapore, in the region, as again to spark the conversation, the convergence about online and offline. It is our right to access the digital domain, but we have to make sure that during the process of accessing information, we will not jeopardize ourselves, you know, jeopardize our own security. And more importantly, in the case of many people whom I have been working, especially those who were radicalized online, know their digital footprint is still out there. You know, what to do? You know, some of them now, for instance, they did horrible posting supporting ISIS, for example, or criticize my government harshly, or maybe condemning any peace activists like me. But now, as I said earlier in my conversation, that being a terrorist or get involved in radicalization as a process, then this kind of started, hang on a minute, all my digital footprint is still horrible. What to do with this? And this is oftentimes hamper or make them difficult for social integration as well. You know, this is something that, you know, I have a conversation with a big bunch of companies like Facebook and Google. What to do with this, you know, with this, their footprint, you know. They no longer believe with what they said. But, you know, the print, the evidence, the digital is still there. You know, the digital, their digital footprint is still there.
Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, you talked about your other films that is still, you know, following the same theme, I would say, about radicalization, especially to young Indonesians via social media. I was wondering, how has social media changed over the years? You started like 2012, 2013 for Jihad Selfie, and now you're still producing, you were saying about Pengantin and also Seeking Imam, which I watched, you shared. Yeah, it's really good. And yeah, I was wondering how does the social media landscape has been changed?
No, so this is the thing. People keep asking me why you have to engage with these people. You know, where I call those reform, I dub them as a credible voice. They have been through difficult situations. They were tricked by social media, you know. And then finally they realized what social media said is actually not all what in the social media, not what all being posted in social media can actually can be trusted. So I organized those formers, I call it Reform, I call it Credible Voice. Specifically, I use the Credible Voice a workshop called CVE workshop, Counter Violent Extremism Communication Workshop. Then I trained them to, you know, to challenge the narrative of their old groups. And then I established a community website called Ruang Obrol. So chat room with the chat room facilities. So let's say Dania, Akbar, they started to share their experience. So I used that this website. The tagline is dare to share. You dare to share your previous mistake using social media, for instance, or how social media has influenced you. And then you manage to get out from the clutch of radicalization within the social media. So that these people, in the website, we have a chat room facility. And to my surprise, you know, I got a call, I got contact from Indonesian who are stranded in Syria camp, you know. And they talk, they have a talking. So from there, we can use technology in a way for our benefit, because then I use the social media to have a conversation with them, decent conversation, try understand the process and identify where are they now, where are their parents now. So I can understand, you know, at the moment I understand where are they coming from. And then I work with a social media company as well, especially Facebook, in the project called Redirecting, where I work I ask these farmers list of a word that usually they use. So, you know, for instance, or specific word. So I have a hundred of a list of word that those radicals usually used to get recruits and to spread their ideology. So if someone type that word in social media, in Facebook, they will redirect to my website. In that website, and then they can read all the material written by our credible voice. So there is a connection between online and offline intervention here. So I'm also with the credible voice too. We have a create what I call it resilient workshop for young people, how to understand digital, on digital literacy. So I span my work now, the youth, and now I establish an application called Rumi, Ruang Migran. This is specifically for migrant worker. So we have a website for migrant worker called Rumi, Ruang Migran, and accompanied by application. So when people can actually share good story there, so hopefully we can have a conversation. So all my initiative always consists of three things. Number one is digitalizations. We always use a digital as a part of our interventions, online and offline. And then secondly, what I call it a strategic intervention that can create a transformative change. This part, because I'm not only interested in individual change, I'm interested in the systematic change. So I want to change the system as well. I want to promote the community ownership of the issue. Many people in Indonesia at least are still in denial that this is part of us, you know, that's digital, that online radicalization is real. That's oftentimes technology pose danger, pose harm rather than good things if you don't know how to handle it right. So this is things. And lastly will be what I call it the financial management, because I'm a social entrepreneur, all the intervention must be self-sustained, you know. So because we cannot come up with an intervention and then disappear after, you know, after we create such interventions, you know.
Right. And I really appreciate your approach that's very systematic. And speaking of the systems, of course, one of the main foundations of all of this is social media, or in particular, the big tech platforms. So how do you think these big tech platforms contribute to making it a fertile ground for radicalization? And also, as you mentioned, the double-edged sword, also a way back for people who have been radicalized?
Because of algorithm also play important role here. When you click a specific word in a specific platform, let's say Google or social media, they tend to fit you, you know, with the same thing. So it's a create echo chamber. So that is like, if you look at my film called Seeking the Imam, Maria can share a little bit, for instance, my main character, Dania, her first interaction to ISIS, to radical group, was not through their direct propaganda, not through violence, but through fashion, you know. So Dania was interested, like, what is the best Islamic fashion? Just click here, click there, and then gradually move into more radical one. Also, like my main character in my current film at the moment, Ika, you know, a migrant worker also in Hong Kong. When she searched for the information was in on social media, was not about jihad, was not about killing, simply about how to be a good Muslim, for instance. All of my stories start off from very simple reason, and sadly, they just want to be a better person. But social media oftentimes drag them, you know, give them a better, not better choices, choices that they are oftentimes unaware. So this is the thing that I think social media, big tech company contributed greatly in the online radicalization process. And it is at the same time now there is a kind of a genuine acknowledgement by social media company to address this issue seriously, therefore engage people like me. Partly it's because of that reason too, you know.
I'm very interested to hear about that. So big tech platforms are contributing to this issue, and they've even went so far as acknowledging their part in it. So what actions have they been taking? And do you think the actions that they have been taking are enough?
Of course, they are admitting, because they, like for instance, when I was involved with the Google initiative, we had a meeting in Dublin where we invited former. So I met terrorists not only from the Muslims, but also from the Christian, neo-Nazi, all of them, Hindu, all of this. So we met, so we discussed what should we do. So I mean, there is a kind of recognition here that this former place from technological company, it was Google who started this initiative first. And then, so I have enough confidence that the big tech company expressed genuine interest of it. And then recently because of my unique connection with many of my friends who was working in tech company, also we start to discuss this very issue too. They try to help people like me and my team to tackle this very issue uniquely, you know, with this technology. But I think they need to do more in terms of providing capacity building and providing digital literacy more to the vulnerable youth, even not necessarily now. Is radicalization is not only about youth now. It's in adult. Even my mom now getting much more radicalized because of WhatsApp, family WhatsApp. You know, because my mom don't really understand between, you know, what should we do if someone receive an information in WhatsApp or through TikTok, through different domain. For her, because she's a 70s in the 70s, for her could be, oh, this is right. But for people like us, we can take a distance a bit, we can compare and contrast different sources. And now this is the thing, you know, this is a new challenge, I think, in the context of online radicalization. It's not only taking place among the youth, but among the adult too. And sadly, people in power use it, for instance, for political purposes. Not only for the jihadists too, oftentimes those who spread the fake news, misinformation, is disinformation, is coming from the people in power, oftentimes coming from politician, you know, who has the power and deliberately use that. So weaponize social media to gain their political purposes. That is also one of the challenges of my work, you know, our work, I think.
Thank you, Masuda. I was wondering, you said that Dania from the film Seeking for Imam got interested in radicalizations or radical ideas through lifestyle, through fashion. Does the organizations that provides this lifestyle guidance, especially Muslim lifestyle, is the same organizations to those who are promoting terrorism or extremist ideas?
No, it's not. It's not initially just like because it's just interested, because back then there was not enough initiative coming from moderate Muslim to what you call it, to give more positive content in the social media. So if you click, let's say, understanding Islam, those who run or click Islam or click Jihad or click Muslim fashion, sadly, those websites or those content were run, was produced by the radicals. So Tania, for instance, when she got interested in fashion, that promotion was not produced by the radical group, but produced by mainstream Muslim fashion businesswoman or business industry. But gradually, you know, it's a gradual process. It's not just click one time and then you become radicals. So it's required processes, you know. And that is processes that I still now I'm working very hard to understand. How can we? Because in our work, we know the term called motivated reasoning. You know, when we always want to get information not to verify but to pick up our own belief first. You know, so there is the problem.
I was wondering. You explained on how does these people get radicalized, and also how does algorithm plays a role in it. But I was wondering in terms of the government response to it, right? Because the Indonesian government have been cracking down Islamist groups since 2017, and especially with 212 demonstrations plays a huge role in public uproar of how does this militias, I would say, can be stopped. How exactly has the government addressed the issues of radicalization, especially in online media?
I think, like most government in the regions, they tend to block and shutting down, that's the direct, you know, all these messages. They block all the messages, let's say, in Facebook or social media, taking down all the messages very fast. But as we know very well, taking down alone will not solve the problem. The group, the producer of that specific content, will emerge in a different platform. Like a hack a mole kind of a, you know, kind of a game, you know. So we hit here, they move other players, we hit here. So in my, because I, that's what my observation, then I come up with this initiative. Why don't we, because people, the reason why I, you know, I'm running now community website called Ruang Obrol, partly because of that, the notion of motivated reasoning, that individual, we, especially we tend to find information that on that will support our existing belief. And we call it bias selection. You know, we select, you know, randomly, you know, and oftentimes government is not the best place to challenge this narrative, because then people say, oh, this is government funded program, or maybe this is a government propaganda. So if we can create kind of a genuine, you know, like a coming from grassroots, I hope it will create conversation more.
And again, that's more like takedowns and these.
Yeah,
are,
more takedown like that.
Yeah, one way. But does that affect nonviolent organizations who are also, you know, organized around Muslim values or Islam values? And how does that affect regular citizens, since it is also vice versa with surveillance?
Yeah, I think, you know, like now, what we are seeing now, the rise, what I call it, conservatism in our country, like in Indonesia, because of this one. Because of the rise of what I call it, Ustadz YouTube, you know, those Ustadz who are very popular in YouTube or in social media. So people stuck to that one. And then those who can't, and oftentimes those Ustadz, sadly, do not promote more tolerant view of Islam. You know, they promote kind of, oftentimes, not all, but many of them promote exclusive, and now exclusive view of Islam. And sadly also, those who share their belief, they copy and paste or cut and paste a specific phrase out of context. It create another problem also, you know.
what we were saying is that a lot of government are now doing, of course, monitoring through social medias. How can we tell the difference between surveillance and monitoring, especially to these groups?
I think if I can paraphrase, another way of saying your question will be, how can we strike the balance between respecting human rights and maintaining the security of order, especially in social media? Because the government, I think, especially security forces will say, look, we are doing our job. You know, we don't want this so-called radical hijack the social media for their own purposes, using for recruitment, coordination, mobilize resources. We don't want that to happen. But oftentimes that right, if we do not really, you know, like monitor it well, can be used for other purposes, especially for political purposes. So the term of radical also problematic and highly contested and politicized in Indonesia. Those who oftentimes the government label a genuine individual or activist who really want to, who really do not feel comfortable with the government policy or want to criticize the government for whatever the reason, and then they can easily be labeled as radicals. So so it's kind of a tricky way, you know.
We've been talking about the government response, and before that, the responsibility and actions that big tech platforms have been taking. Now let's look at what the grassroots, the civil society, the non-government organizations like yourself have been doing to address this issue. So can you talk about the efforts? How effective have they been? What are the biggest challenges in doing them?
I think it sounds cliche to say what we need to do is actually will be pentahelic approach, collaboration between government, civil society, and also big tech company to tackle this issue together. But people like me, people like us in the grassroots, we have a genuine intention to tackle this issue creatively. We have a lot of ideas, but sadly we don't have the money, and oftentimes we don't have the authority. We don't have the legitimacy, you know. So in a country like Indonesia, for instance, oftentimes governments still play significant role. They are much more respected, you know, in specific area. But because of the nature of the government, they are not that nimble, you know, they are not that flexible to deal with this issue. They need to follow what I call it, the politic of budget, you know. So if they already decided a plan to run a specific project in government with maybe within 1 year or 3 years or 5 years. If they do not mention that specific particular, term digital literacy or preventing online radicalization, that specific word, they will be very hard to disperse the expenses, you know, to use this as a one of the important and a strategic program. So in a way, what we need to have will be that collaboration. We need to see a government official who has entrepreneurial skill, you know. They can see the problem and then often then tackle it differently. Because, and I strongly believe there are individuals in my government who can do like that, you know, who can act very nimble and then see a bigger picture rather than solely protecting their own interests. For instance, the fact that I was given access to the repatriation process by my government, it suggests that my government is open for people like me, you know, to document the process and then engage them. So but we need more. We need more government in the region, not only in Indonesia, provide more space for civil society, academics, and also the big tech company to get deeply involved in this. Because I strongly believe this issue of online radicalization, digital right, the idea that we can access the digital space safely will not go away anytime soon, you know. Technology company will never close down their company. They will create a lot of innovation to grab our attentions. And then one has to remember that technological company is not only about technological company. They are psychological company. They are designed to hack us emotionally. Look at the notification, red notification, or sharing, like, and then how many share. It's challenged the way we behave. And then if there is a connection between our biology and social and technology, because when we get like, it produces specific dopamine, you know, specific, you know, in our body. And oftentimes, because sadly we believe that democracy is not the best system, but this is the thing that we now know of, you know. What? And then with social media, the might, the right, you know, the more follower you are, you more have, you know, you more have political things, you know, the political power, even though you are dumb, you know. They're like, I'm not saying this. Many of my fellow Indonesians, they are in my standard, as someone enough study. They are quite dumb, but if I produce a good research in my social media platform, maybe the like is super slow. But those people are dumb. Maybe, I don't know, doing a lot of this here. I don't want to say bad things about other people, but I don't know what they contribute, but yet their followers is a million, you know. And this is the problem, people like me, you know, I have plenty of ideas, I read so many books, I want to genuinely contribute to society. But my messages can be easily killed by a story of, oh, this guy divorced, oh, this guy turned out gay, this guy, this, all with artist gossip, easily can crush all my good messages with fancy word. Oh, the right for digital right, you know, the safety in the internet, the future. Can easily kill, oh, Maria Ozawa come to Indonesia and become Muslim. Wow, maybe, wow, this has become hit easily. But I don't know whether that such content can actually help us to become a better human being. I don't know. I mean, like,
that is quite the challenge. You mentioned that this is something common to human beings, no matter where they are. And the problems in the region undoubtedly have some things in common about them as well, and some things are different. So in your experience, like working on different issues in different countries, you mentioned that you were in the Philippines, for example. What do you think are the main differences and similarities of your de-radicalization work in countries like Indonesia or the Philippines and others in the Asia Pacific?
The similarity will be what I call it triple N. Number one, needs, individual quest for significant recognitions. And then, you know, that is the things. If you have that issue, and everyone like us always try to get recognitions, social approval, might lead us in, we will keep searching. And then number two, secondly, will be, and those people who I've been talking to, they're attracted to this quick fix to their life through social media. And then oftentimes we come up with the term radicalization using religions, either in Indonesia, here, Singapore, Malaysia, in Southern Philippines. They want to have a quick fix in their life because moderate, liberal, or sophisticated like us, we do not have a fixed answer for fixed things. Unlike religion, quick fix. You believe this, you will go to straight to heaven. If you don't do this, you will be roasted in hell. You know, it's very clear. In reality, life is not like that. But those who are searching for clarity, cannot embrace ambiguity, will be the, what you call it, vulnerable individual to get easily swayed by narrative of the radical online and offline. Number two, what I call it, the notion of network. In Indonesia, we have what we call it homegrown radical group, like Darul Islam, JI. We have a group that advocating specifically to change our secular system of Pancasila, you know, our country, you know, the system that we already believe, that we know firmly believe that we need to respect the difference, celebrate it, like what a system, what we call it. This organization has been working very hard to change that system. So we have a network, but now the network also immersed themselves in online space. The same in Southern Philippines too, you know, there are a number of organizations like Abu Sayyaf and then BIF. I don't want to call MIF as a terrorist, but, you know, like as many of them join that route first and then disgruntle and then find their network. So basically, Those people need to have a network. And last one will be what I call it narrative. They succumb to, they attracted to a quick fix narrative, a narrative that allowed them to kind of a narrative that give them a quick answer, clear things to see the world. So this is the similarities. The difference, of course, will be the context.
We've seen that you have spent a significant amount of time and effort in trying to de-radicalize people, not only young men, but also women, teenagers. I was wondering, what have you learned in doing this so far? And if you would advise others who are interested to also contribute in this effort, what would that be?
It is not rocket science to do all my work. People always label me, oh, you try to help them to de-radicalize. No, I just help them to find their new calling in their life, you know. Because I have a unique background. It has to do with my personal background. I used to be part of the network myself. So I know many of them. They are not like that. They are shaped by specific processes in their life. So if anyone want to run this, if anyone want to do similar type of work like what I have been doing, I coin into three simple steps, what I call it triple H approach. Number one will be heart. You need to have a big heart. You need to have empathy. You need to understand, listening. Because to me, understanding doesn't mean supporting. Understand the processes. Basically, to be human, you must be humane. To be human, you must be humane. For humanize them. They are normal. They have become like that because of the specific circumstances in their life. Therefore, Hannah Arendt said in my early conversation, come up with the term banality of evil. Those who get involved in the killing of Nazi camp, apparently, according to conclusion of Hannah Arendt in trial, oh my God, this guy is just banal. They are normal. They play piano in the morning. They drink milk, have a nice breakfast with their family, and then go to the concentration camp and come back. They are not monstrous as a person, but because of specific condition, context make them like that. So number one will be hard. You need to win their trust first. And to win their trust, you need to listen. And when to do that, you must to be honest. Be yourself. You don't lie. And then being authentic is very important. And last one, you have to have a good logic. Logic means you explain, you know, logically what you are doing. Number two, I call it, number two will be hand. You need to, hand will be transforming, give them a skill, give them a meaning. So give them something to look for when they get up early in the morning. In my case, I transform the skill of those returned foreign fighter, from using AK-47 to fried duck. You know, those who get my first client, you know, like Yusuf, he was a Moro fighter. He was involved in Indonesian who fought in Mindanao for 2 years. So come back, arrested, and I interviewed him inside the prisons. And then I'm in Indonesia, as you know, I'm running a cafe where many many realist terrorists work there. So give them skill, so that they know what they when they came, they have something to look for. In a cafe business, in hospitality business, you cannot choose your customer. Everyone come, you need to respect. If they have a complaint with their coffee, listen. Transform their hatred into serving others. So this is what I call hand. Last one will be head. We challenge the idea. After earning trust, after giving them kind of a specific skill in their life, then the last one will be what you said, de-radicalization. We challenge their very ideology. When they reform, they renounce violence. What I call them, they have become the agent of change. And we go into the next level, what I call it multi-level marketing of kindness. They recruit others. And we use this individual as a credible voice in my film, in my books, in my website. So it's a long process. But eventually, as I said, I'm not only interested in this individual change, I'm interested in the structural change. So I work with I work with the community level, you know, in Central Java. I work with the governor of Central Java, Pak Ganjar, Mas Ganjar. Ganjar, he's deeply involved in my film called The Mentor, involved meeting with farmers. And then if the whole thing's run well, he could be the president. So you can see this, you know, structural change that I'm really trying to push. And if I have a credible voice, so I consider my credible voice using a Chinese medical term. Because of the way I work, because I'm small, but I really want to make a structural change, acupuncturist approach. So these people is my needle. So if you poke correctly, you can actually make a real systematic change, you know.
And aside from watching your films, reading your books, and visiting your cafe, are there any new projects that you are working on that we can look forward to?
The initiative just started this month because I selected this month because this is the Woman Day, the International Woman Day. And then our website, community website called Rumi, Ruang Migrant, Ruang Space Migrant, Migrant. We have the applications. And then the person who is in charge for this is a former migrant worker herself. Her name is Ani Emma. She used to work in Hong Kong and did wonderful film. She won the best film, documentary film in Indonesia called Piala Citra. So she has been with me for at least 2 years. She believed my cause. I sent her to Australia to see other initiative coming back. Now she championed this initiative. We will start here in Singapore first. I'm going to train at least 5 migrant workers here and then move into 10. If it runs smoothly, I will move to Hong Kong, then to Korea. Those who have enough legal framework to protect our migrant worker, because there are 7 million Indonesian migrant workers, and most of them glued to social media to find information among themselves. If we cannot help them feel safe using social media, it will be horrible. I mean, and because I've been talking to those people, some of them are genuinely want to start new life, better life. But because of lack of understanding of the nature of social media, some of them were recruited and then broken heart, and I interviewed them, I'm crying inside all the time. My God, you really want to change your life? You travel all the way. Maybe because, you know, you can relate easily, because I met here also a number of Filipinos too, but in Indonesian context, they're coming from difficult families, you know. They're not coming from, you know, upper class. They're from middle class, sadly, and they're less educated. And then this social media, because of that lack of that knowledge. So yeah, it's all my initiative is genuinely driven by humanity, you know. It's no rocket science. You need to have a big empathy.
We definitely look forward to hearing more about your work, and thank you so much for joining us today, Mas Nur Huda.
Thank you for having me. I hope this is just the beginning of our wonderful cooperation in the future.
There was certainly a lot to discuss. I felt like we had 2 more episodes worth of things to talk about, but a few takeaways really come to mind when I remember our conversation. One is that very palpable feeling that I got from Mas Nur Huda, this frustration that he felt, right? When he shared with us, he could write academic books, like produce very well-researched films, but all of that hard work can be undermined by just a tweet on social media, just by something short. An influencer who does not put in as much effort to study and learn the nuances of the issue can have so much power. And what he's doing, the work that he's doing, is part of this wider effort, really to bring back the nuance into the conversations, into the discourse. Religion is, of course, one of those very difficult topics that could stand to gain from this very deliberate and meaningful engagement with the issues, rather than just this quick fix answers that radicalization or those who want to radicalize others often use. What did you take away from that, Maria?
Yeah, thank you, Red. It's actually echoing in what you were saying about the use of social media and how influencers has been using social media to me is that when he said that we always need to use our heart, our hand, and our head in supporting a more tolerant social media and more tolerant digital spaces to begin with, and especially in Indonesia, when all these discussions are happening online, can we actually still exert our values of tolerance and diversity on social media?
I agree. And certainly we can read more about Masnoor Huda's work, watch his films, and all of these things that we've mentioned throughout the episode, some additional context, will be in the accompanying article to this podcast. Be sure to check it out on engagemedia.org/podcast. Please be sure to like and share and subscribe to this episode. The various platforms are available on that page. Thank you so much, and see you on the next episode.